Eyewitness News and a special report coming up at 7:30.
Blog Talk Radio.
ABC 7, Eyewitness News.
Marvin didn't try to be magic or charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see?
Jimmy's Underground Radio Network. I was trying to do my special on The Last Stand and Christopher Donner. Seems like they had him trapped down in a cabin, and all of a sudden it caught fire. I was trying to bring some live coverage from KABC. I was monitoring it all day, but they just went to the president's inauguration. So what I'm going to do is start the show off. If you want this inauguration, go ahead on. Normally I play it. Maybe I might play some of it, but keep my show going on because I want to just deal with this manifesto. So you're out there listening. We're going to be going back and forth from the president to the manifesto. I'm going to try to bring you up to date on what's been going on with the Christopher Donner case. Is this the guy? Is this him? Or is this another trick? It's not the show, Ebony.
The man you're about to see in here, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing along. Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven ring, ring with the harmony, oh, liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high, burning the time.
march on till victory won. God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who has brought us this far,
and plus I've never been. I'm on a tier with no tears should ever fall. pocket, y'all. Cause time and time again, time they got me serving to both of them. I'm not a citizen, but ever when I catch the CO, sleeping on the job, I'm planning on going ahead. I want to speak, but I'm going to tell you the deal. I got nothing to lose.
In multiple killings in California. Authorities have been digging
like
hundreds
every company
of the
Facebook page thing is
still at large. But he was charged today with the murder of a Riverside police officer and the attempted murder of other officers.
These
charges could be a death penalty.
Relationship.
The manhunt was in its fifth day. Law enforcement agencies across Southern California kept looking for Christopher Dorn. Authorities said they're hoping a $1 million reward will yield new leads on Dorner's whereabouts.
Our dedication to catching this killer remains steadfast.
Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa announced the award yesterday.
Communities who will not tolerate this reign of terror that has robbed us of the peace of mind that residents of Southern California deserve.
Dorner is wanted for the murder of a retired police captain's daughter and her fiancé in Irvine 8 days ago. The 33-year-old fugitive also allegedly killed a Riverside police officer in an ambush last Thursday. Investigators fear Dorner plans more killings as revenge against the L.A. Police Department. It fired him 5 years ago for falsely accusing his training officer of kicking a suspect. Authorities found Dorner's burned pickup truck near the Big Bear Ski Resort late last week, but they've since been forced to scale back the search in order to protect 50 police families believed to be in danger while still answering regular calls for assistance. Police Chief Charlie Beck.
Obviously, we're getting tips since the reward offer like crazy. We have three times the amount of tips that we did yesterday. We're following up on every one of them, you know, so hopefully there's a nugget in there that will lead us to his capture.
So far, there have only been false sightings of Dorner, including one at this Northridge area Lowe's store yesterday. Meanwhile, the L.A. Police Department has reopened its investigation into the case that prompted Dorner's firing.
I spoke to Mayor Villaraigosa a short time ago to discuss how the city's dealing with the manhunt, as well as some of the questions raised by this case. Mayor, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's start with the state of the search. Is there any...
I'm going to leave it from there. I got a lot of you all saying, go in there and play the presidential debate. So this is y'all. 347-838-9825. I'm going to continue the story about Dorner.
After a decade of grinding war, our brave men and reform are coming home. After years of grueling recession, our businesses have created over 6 million new jobs. We buy more American cars than we have in 5 years, and less foreign oil than we have in 20. Our housing market is healing, our stock market is rebounding, and consumers, patients, and homeowners enjoy stronger protections than ever before. So, together, we have cleared away the rubble of crisis. And we can say with renewed confidence that the state of our union is stronger. But we gather here knowing that there are millions of Americans whose hard work and dedication have not yet been rewarded. Our economy is adding jobs, but too many people still can't find full-time employment. Corporate profits have skyrocketed to all-time highs, but for more than a decade, wages and incomes have barely budged. It is our generation's task, then, to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth, a rising, thriving middle class. It is our unfinished task to restore the basic bargain that built this country. The idea that if you work hard and meet your responsibilities, you can get ahead, no matter where you come from, no matter what you look like or who you love. It is our unfinished task to make sure that this government works on behalf of the many, and not just the few, that it encourages free enterprise, rewards individual initiative, and opens the doors of opportunity to every child across this great nation. The American people don't expect government to solve every problem. They don't expect those of us in this chamber to agree on every issue. But they do expect us to put the nation's interests before party. They do expect us to forge reasonable compromise where we can. But they know that America moves forward only when we do so together, and that the responsibility of improving this union remains the task of us all. Now, our work must begin by making some basic decisions about our budget, decisions that will have a huge impact on the strength of our recovery. Over the last few years, both parties have worked together to reduce the deficit by more than $2.5 trillion, mostly through spending cuts, but also by raising tax rates on the wealthiest 1% of Americans. As a result, we are more than halfway towards the goal of $4 trillion in deficit reduction that economists say we need to stabilize our finances. Now we need to finish the job. And the question is, how? In 2011, Congress passed a law saying that if both parties couldn't agree on a plan to reach our deficit goal, about $1 trillion worth of budget cuts would automatically go into effect this year. These sudden, harsh, arbitrary cuts would jeopardize our military readiness. They'd devastate priorities like education and energy and medical research. They would certainly slow our recovery and cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs. And that's why Democrats, Republicans, business leaders, and economists have already said that these cuts, known here in Washington as the sequester, are a really bad idea. Now, some in Congress have proposed preventing only the defense cuts by making even bigger cuts to things like education and job training, Medicare, and Social Security benefits. That idea is even worse. Yes, the biggest driver of our long-term debt is the rising cost of health care for an aging population. And those of us who care deeply about programs like Medicare must embrace the need for modest reforms. Otherwise, our retirement programs will crowd out the investments we need for our children and jeopardize the promise of a secure retirement for future generations. But we can't ask senior citizens and working families to shoulder the entire burden of deficit reduction while asking nothing more from the wealthiest and the most powerful. We won't grow the middle class simply by shifting the cost of health care or college onto families that are already struggling, or by forcing communities to lay off more teachers and more cops and more firefighters. Most Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, understand that we can't just cut our way to prosperity. They know that broad-based economic growth requires a balanced approach to deficit reduction, with spending cuts and revenue, and with everybody doing their fair share. And that's the approach I offer tonight. On Medicare, I'm prepared to enact reforms that will achieve the same amount of health care savings by the beginning of the next decade as the reforms proposed by the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission. Already, the Affordable Care Act is helping to slow the growth of health care costs. And the reforms I'm proposing go even further. We'll reduce taxpayer subsidies to prescription drug companies and ask more from the wealthiest seniors. We'll bring down costs by changing the way our government pays for Medicare, because our medical bills shouldn't be based on the number of tests ordered or days spent in the hospital. They should be based on the quality of care that our seniors receive. And I am open to additional reforms from both parties, so long as they don't violate the guarantee of a secure retirement. Our government shouldn't make promises we cannot keep, but we must keep the promises we've already made. to hit the rest of our deficit reduction target. We should do what leaders in both parties have already suggested and save hundreds of billions of dollars by getting rid of tax loopholes and deductions for the well-off and the well-connected. After all, why would we choose to make deeper cuts to education and Medicare just to protect special interest tax breaks? How is that fair? Why is the deficit reduction is a big emergency, justifying making cuts in Social Security benefits but not closing some loopholes? How does that promote growth? Now is our best chance for bipartisan, comprehensive tax reform that encourages job creation and helps bring down the deficit. We can get this done. The American people deserve a tax code that helps small businesses spend less time filling out complicated forms and more time expanding and hiring. A tax code that ensures billionaires with high-powered accountants can't work the system and pay a lower rate than their hard-working secretaries. A tax code that lowers incentives to move jobs overseas and lowers tax rates for businesses and manufacturers that are creating jobs right here in the United States of America. That's what tax reform can deliver. That's what we can do together. I realize that tax reform and entitlement reform will not be easy. The politics will be hard for both sides. None of us will get 100% of what we want. But the alternative will cost us jobs, hurt our economy, visit hardship on millions of hardworking Americans. So let's set party interests aside and work to pass a budget that replaces reckless cuts with smart savings and wise investments in our future. And let's do it without the brinksmanship that stresses consumers and scares off investors. The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufacturing crisis to the next. We can't do it. Let's agree right here, right now, to keep the people's government open and pay our bills on time and always uphold the full faith and credit of the United States of America. The American people have worked too hard for too long rebuilding from one crisis to see their elected officials cause another. Now, most of us agree that a plan to reduce the deficit must be part of our agenda. But let's be clear. Deficit reduction alone is not an economic plan. A growing economy that creates good middle-class jobs, that must be the North Star that guides our efforts. Every day, we should ask ourselves three questions as a nation. How do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living? A year and a half ago, I put forward an American Jobs Act that independent economists said would create more than 1 million new jobs. And I thank the last Congress for passing some of that agenda. I urge this Congress to pass the rest. But tonight I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat. Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime. It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth. That's what we should be looking for. Our first priority is making America a magnet for new jobs in manufacturing. After shedding jobs for more than 10 years, our manufacturers have added about 500,000 jobs over the past three. Caterpillar is bringing jobs back from Japan. Ford is bringing jobs back from Mexico. And this year, Apple will start making Macs in America again. There are things we can do right now to accelerate this trend. Last year, we created our first Manufacturing Innovation Institute in Youngstown, Ohio. A once-shuttered warehouse is now a state-of-the-art lab where new workers are mastering the 3D printing that has the potential to revolutionize the way we make almost everything. There's no reason this can't happen in other towns. So tonight, I'm announcing the launch of three more of these manufacturing hubs where businesses will partner with the Department of Defense and Energy to turn regions left behind by globalization into global centers of high-tech jobs. And I ask this Congress to help create a network of 15 of these hubs and guarantee that the next revolution in manufacturing is made right here in America. We can get that done. Now, if we want to make the best products, we also have to invest in the best ideas. Every dollar we invested to map the human genome returned $140 to our economy. Every dollar. Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's. They're developing drugs to regenerate damaged organs, devising new materials to make batteries 10 times more powerful. Now is not the time to gut these job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development not seen since the height of the space race. We need to make those investments. Today, no area holds more promise than our investments in American energy. After years of talking about it, we're finally poised to control our own energy future. We produce more oil at home than we have in 15 years. We have doubled the distance our cars will go on a gallon of gas and the amount of renewable energy we generate from sources like wind and solar, with tens of thousands of good American jobs to show for it. We produce more natural gas than ever before, and nearly everyone's energy bill is lower because of it. And over the last 4 years, our emissions of the dangerous carbon pollution that threatens our planet have actually fallen. But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change. It's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 15. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late. Now, the good news is we can make meaningful progress on this issue while driving strong economic growth. I urge this Congress to get together, pursue a bipartisan market-based solution to climate change, like the one John McCain and Joe Lieberman worked on together a few years ago. But if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will. I will direct I will direct my cabinet to come up with executive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable sources of energy. And 4 years ago, other countries dominated the clean energy market and the jobs that came with it. And we've begun to change that. Last year, wind only half of all new power capacity in America. So let's generate even more. Solar energy gets cheaper by the year. Let's drive down costs even further. As long as countries like China keep going all in on clean energy, so must we. In the meantime, the natural gas boom has led to cleaner power and greater energy independence. We need to encourage that. That's why my administration will keep cutting red tape and speeding up new oil and gas permits. That's got to be part of an all-of-the-above plan. But I also want to work with this Congress to encourage the research and technology that helps natural gas burn even cleaner and protects our air and our water. In fact, much of our newfound energy is drawn from lands and waters that we, the public, own together. So tonight I propose we use some of our oil and gas revenues to fund an energy security trust that will drive new research and technology to shift our cars and trucks off oil for good. If a nonpartisan coalition of CEOs and retired generals and admirals can get behind this idea, then so can we. Let's take their advice and free our families and businesses from the painful spikes in gas prices we put up with for far too long. I'm also issuing a new goal for America. Let's cut in half the energy wasted by our homes and businesses over the next 20 years. We'll work with the states to do it. Those states with the best ideas to create jobs and lower energy bills by constructing more efficient buildings will receive federal support to help make that happen. America's energy sector is just one part of an aging infrastructure badly in need of repair. Ask any CEO where they'd rather locate and hire, a country with deteriorating roads and bridges, or one with high-speed rail and internet, high-tech schools, self-healing power grids. The CEO of Siemens America, a company that brought hundreds of new jobs to North Carolina, said that if we upgrade our infrastructure, they'll bring even more jobs. And that's the attitude of a lot of companies all around the world. And I know you want these job-creating projects in your district. I've seen all those ribbon cuttings. So, tonight, I propose a fix-it-first program to put people to work as soon as possible on our most urgent repairs, like the nearly 70,000 structurally deficient bridges across the country. And to make sure taxpayers don't shoulder the whole burden, I'm also proposing a partnership to rebuild America that attracts private capital to upgrade what our businesses need most. Modern ports to move our goods. Modern pipelines to withstand a storm. Modern schools worthy of our children. Let's prove there's no better place to do business than here in the United States of America. And let's start right away. We can get this done. And part of our rebuilding effort must also involve our housing sector. The good news is our housing market is finally healing from the collapse of 2007. Home prices are rising at the fastest pace in 6 years. Home purchases are up nearly 50%, and construction is expanding again. But even with mortgage rates near a 50-year low, too many families with solid credit who want to buy a home are being rejected. Too many families who never missed a payment and want to refinance are being told no. That's holding our entire economy back. We need to fix it. Right now, there's a bill in this Congress that would give every responsible homeowner in America the chance to save $3,000 a year by refinancing at today's rates. Democrats and Republicans have supported it before. So what are we waiting for? Take a vote and send me that bill. Why would we be against that? Why would that be a partisan issue? Helping folks refinance. Right now, overlapping regulations keep responsible young families from buying their first home. What's holding us back? Let's streamline the process and help our economy grow. So these initiatives in manufacturing, energy, infrastructure, housing, all these things will help entrepreneurs and small business owners expand and create new jobs. But none of it will matter unless we also equip our citizens with the skills and training to fill those jobs. And that has to start at the earliest possible age. You know, study after study shows the sooner a child begins learning, the better he or she does down the road. But today, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. So tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do. Every dollar we invest in high-quality early childhood education can save more than $7 later on by boosting graduation rates, reducing teen pregnancy, even reducing violent crime. In states that make it a priority to educate our youngest children, like Georgia or Oklahoma, studies show students grow up more likely to read and do math at grade level, graduate high school, hold a job, form more stable families of their own. We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance. Let's also make sure that a high school diploma puts our kids on a path to a good job. Right now, countries like Germany focus on graduating their high school students with the equivalent of a technical degree from one of our community colleges. So those German kids, they're ready for a job when they graduate high school. They've been trained for the jobs that are there. Now at schools like PTEC in Brooklyn, a collaboration between New York Public Schools and City University of New York and IBM, students will graduate with a high school diploma and an associate's degree in computers or engineering. We need to give every American student opportunities like this. And 4 years ago, we started Race to the Top, a competition that convinced almost every state to develop smarter curricula and higher standards, all for about 1% of what we spend on education each year. Tonight, I'm announcing a new challenge: to redesign America's high schools so they better equip graduates for the demands of a high-tech economy. And we'll reward schools that develop new partnerships with colleges and employers and create classes that focus on science, technology, engineering, and math, the skills today's employers are looking for to fill the jobs that are there right now and will be there in the future. Now, even with better high schools, most young people will need some higher education. The simple fact, the more education you've got, the more likely you are to have a good job and work your way into the middle class. But today, skyrocketing costs price too many young people out of a higher education or saddle them with unsustainable debt. Through tax credits, grants, and better loans, we've made college more affordable for millions of students and families over the last few years. But taxpayers can't keep on subsidizing higher and higher and higher costs for higher education. Colleges must do their part to keep costs down, and it's our job to make sure that they do. So tonight, I ask Congress to change the Higher Education Act so that affordability and value are included in determining which colleges receive certain types of federal aid. And tomorrow, my administration will release a new college scorecard that parents and students can use to compare schools based on a simple criteria, where you can get the most bang for your educational buck. Now, to grow our middle class, our citizens have to have access to the education and training that today's jobs require. But we also have to make sure that America remains a place where everyone who's willing to work, everybody who's willing to work hard, has the chance to get ahead. Our economy is stronger when we harness the talents and ingenuity of striving, hopeful immigrants. And right now, leaders from the business, labor, law enforcement, faith communities, they all agree that the time has come to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now's the time to do it. Now's the time to get it done. Now's the time to get it done. Real reform means stronger border security, and we can build on the progress my administration has already made, putting more boots on the southern border than at any time in our history, and reducing illegal crossings to their lowest levels in 40 years. Real reform means establishing a responsible pathway to earned citizenship, a path that includes passing a background check, paying taxes and a meaningful penalty, learning English, and going to the back of the line behind the folks trying to come here legally. And real reform means fixing the legal immigration system to cut waiting periods and attract the highly skilled entrepreneurs and engineers that will help create jobs and grow our economy. In other words, we know what needs to be done. And as we speak, bipartisan groups in both chambers are working diligently to draft a bill, and I applaud their efforts. So let's get this done. Send me a comprehensive immigration reform bill in the next few months, and I will sign it right away, and America will be better for it. Let's get it done. Let's get it done. We can't stop there. We know our economy is stronger when our wives, our mothers, our daughters can live their lives free from discrimination in the workplace and free from the fear of domestic violence. Today, the Senate passed the Violence Against Women's Act that Joe Biden originally wrote almost 20 years ago, and I now urge the House to do the same. Good job, Joe. And I ask this Congress to declare that women should earn a living equal to their efforts. And finally pass the Paycheck Fairness Act this year. We know our economy is stronger when we reward an honest day's work with honest wages. But today, a full-time worker making the minimum wage earns $14,500 a year, even with the tax relief we put in place. A family with two kids that earns the minimum wage still lives below the poverty line. That's wrong. That's why, since the last time this Congress raised the minimum wage, 19 states have chosen to bump theirs even higher. Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. We should be able to get that done. This single step would raise the incomes of millions of working families. It could mean the difference between groceries or the food bank, rent or eviction, scraping by or finally getting ahead. For businesses across the country, it would mean customers with more money in their pockets. And a whole lot of folks out there would probably need less help from governments. In fact, working folks shouldn't have to wait year after year for the minimum wage to go up, while CEO pay has never been higher. So here's an idea that Governor Romney and I actually agreed on last year. Let's tie the minimum wage to the cost of living so that it finally becomes a wage you can live on. Tonight, let's also recognize that there are communities in this country where, no matter how hard you work, it is virtually impossible to get ahead. Factory towns decimated from years of plants packing up, inescapable pockets of poverty, urban and rural, where young adults are still fighting for their first job. America is not a place where the chance of birth or circumstance should decide our destiny. And that's why we need to build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class for all who are willing to climb them. Let's offer incentives to companies that hire Americans who've got what it takes to fill that job opening but have been out of work so long that no one will give them a chance anymore. Let's put people back to work rebuilding vacant homes and rundown neighborhoods. And this year, my administration will begin to partner with 20 of the hardest-hit towns in America to get these communities back on their feet. Now, we'll work with local leaders to target resources and public safety and education and housing. We'll give new tax credits to businesses that hire and invest. And we'll work to strengthen families by removing the financial deterrence to marriage for low-income couples and do more to encourage fatherhood. Because what makes you a man isn't the ability to conceive a child. It's having the courage to raise one. And we want to encourage that. We want to help that. Stronger families, stronger communities, a stronger America. It is this kind of prosperity, broad, shared, built on a thriving middle class, that has always been the source of our progress at home. It's also the foundation of our power and influence throughout the world. Tonight we stand united in saluting the troops and civilians who sacrifice every day to protect us. Because of them, we can say with confidence that America will complete its mission in Afghanistan and achieve our objective of defeating the core of Al-Qaeda. Already, we have brought home 33,000 of our brave servicemen and women. This spring, our forces will move into a support role, while Afghan security forces take the lead. Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over. Beyond 2014, America's commitment to a unified and sovereign Afghanistan will endure. But the nature of our commitment will change. We're negotiating an agreement with the Afghan government that focuses on two missions: training and equipping Afghan forces so that the country does not again slip into chaos, and counterterrorism efforts that allow us to pursue the remnants of Al-Qaeda and their affiliates. Today, the organization that attacked us on 9/11 is a shadow of its former self. It's true, different al-Qaeda affiliates and extremist groups have emerged from the Arabian Peninsula to Africa. The threat these groups pose is evolving. But to meet this threat, we don't need to send tens of thousands of our sons and daughters abroad or occupy other nations. Instead, we'll need to help countries like Yemen, Libya, Somalia provide for their own security and help allies who take the fight to terrorists, as we have in Mali. And where necessary, through a range of capabilities, we will continue to take direct action against those terrorists who pose the gravest threat to Americans. Now, as we do, we must enlist our values in the fight. That's why my administration has worked tirelessly to forge a durable legal and policy framework to guide our counterterrorism efforts. Throughout, we have kept Congress fully informed of our efforts. And I recognize that in our democracy, no one should just take my word for it that we're doing things the right way. In the months ahead, I will continue to engage Congress to ensure not only that our targeting, detention, and prosecution of terrorists remains consistent with our laws and system of checks and balances, but that our efforts are even more transparent to the American people and to the world. Of course, our challenges don't end with al-Qaeda. America will continue to lead the effort to prevent the spread of the world's most dangerous weapons. The regime in North Korea must know they will only achieve security and prosperity by meeting their international obligations. Provocations of the sort we saw last night will only further isolate them. As we stand by our allies, strengthen our own missile defense, and lead the world in taking firm action in response to these threats. Likewise, the leaders of Iran must recognize that now is the time for a diplomatic solution, because a coalition stands united in demanding that they meet their obligations, and we will do what is necessary to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. At the same time, we'll engage Russia to seek further reductions in our nuclear arsenals and continue leading the global effort to secure nuclear materials that could fall into the wrong hands. Because our ability to influence others depends on our willingness to lead and meet our obligations. America must also face the rapidly growing threat from cyber attacks. Now, we know hackers steal people's identities and infiltrate private emails. We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy. That's why earlier today, I signed a new executive order that will strengthen our cyber defenses by increasing information sharing and developing standards to protect our national security, our jobs, and our privacy. But now Congress must act as well by passing legislation to give our government a greater capacity to secure our networks and deter attacks. This is something we should be able to get done on a bipartisan basis. Now, even as we protect our people, we should remember that today's world presents not just dangers, not just threats, it presents opportunities. To boost American exports, support American jobs, and level the playing field in the growing markets of Asia, we intend to complete negotiations on a Trans-Pacific Partnership. And tonight I'm announcing that we will launch talks on a comprehensive transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the European Union, because trade that is fair and free across the Atlantic supports millions of good-paying American jobs. We also know that progress in the most impoverished parts of our world enriches us all. Not only because it creates new markets, more stable order in certain regions of the world, but also because it's the right thing to do. You know, in many places, people live on little more than a dollar a day. So the United States will join with our allies to eradicate such extreme poverty in the next two decades by connecting more people to the global economy, by empowering women, by giving our young and brightest minds new opportunities to serve, and helping communities to feed, empower, and educate themselves, by saving the world's children from preventable deaths, and by realizing the promise of an AIDS-free generation, which is within our reach. You see, America must remain a beacon to all who seek freedom during this period of historic change. I saw the power of hope last year in Rangoon, in Burma, when Aung San Suu Kyi welcomed an American president into the home where she had been imprisoned for years. When thousands of Burmese lined the streets waving American flags, including a man who said, "There is justice and law in the United States. I want our country to be like that." In defense of freedom, we'll remain the anchor of strong alliances from the Americas to Africa, from Europe to Asia. In the Middle East, we will stand with citizens as they demand their universal rights and support stable transitions to democracy. We know the process will be messy, and we cannot presume to dictate the course of change in countries like Egypt, but we can and will insist on respect for the fundamental rights of all people. We'll keep the pressure on a Syrian regime that has murdered its own people and support opposition leaders that respect the rights of every Syrian. And we will stand steadfast with Israel in pursuit of security and a lasting peace. Messages I'll deliver when I travel to the Middle East next month. And all this work depends on the courage and sacrifice of those who serve in dangerous places at great personal risk. Our diplomats, our intelligence officers, and the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. As long as I'm Commander-in-Chief, we will do whatever we must to protect those who serve their country abroad, and we will maintain the best military the world has ever known. We'll invest in new capabilities, even as we reduce waste and wartime spending. We will ensure equal treatment for all service members and equal benefits for their families, gay and straight. We will draw upon the courage and skills of our sisters and daughters and moms, because women have proven under fire that they are ready for combat. We will keep faith with our veterans, investing in world-class care, including mental health care for our wounded warriors. Supporting our military families, giving our veterans the benefits and education and job opportunities that they have earned. And I want to thank my wife, Michelle, and Dr. Jill Biden for their continued dedication to serving our military families as well as they have served us. Thank you, honey. Thank you, Jill. Defending our freedom, though, is not just the job of our military alone. We must all do our part to make sure our God-given rights are protected here at home. That includes one of the most fundamental rights of a democracy, the right to vote. Well, when any American, no matter where they live or what their party, are denied that right because they can't afford to wait for 5 or 6 or 7 hours just to cast their ballot, we are betraying our ideals. So tonight I'm announcing a nonpartisan commission to improve the voting experience in America, and it definitely needs improvement. I'm asking 2 longtime experts in the field, who, by the way, recently served as the top attorneys for my campaign and for Governor Romney's campaign, to lead it. We can fix this, and we will. The American people demand it, and so does our democracy. Of course, what I've said tonight matters little if we don't come together to protect our most precious resource, our children. It has been 2 months since Newtown. I know this is not the first time this country has debated how to reduce gun violence, but this time is different. Overwhelming majorities of Americans who believe in the Second Amendment, have come together around common sense reform, like background checks that will make it harder for criminals to get their hands on a gun. Senators of both parties are working together on tough new laws to prevent anyone from buying guns for resale to criminals. Police chiefs are asking our help to get weapons of war and massive ammunition magazines off our streets because these police chiefs, they're tired of seeing their guys and gals being outgunned. Each of these proposals deserves a vote in Congress. If you want to vote no, that's your choice. But these proposals deserve a vote. Because in the 2 months since Newtown, more than 1,000 birthdays, graduations, anniversaries have been stolen from our lives by a bullet from a gun. More than 1,000. One of those we lost was a young girl named Nydia Pendleton. She was 15 years old. She loved Fig Newtons and Lip Gloss. She was a majorette. She was so good to her friends, they all thought they were her best friend. Just 3 weeks ago, she was here in Washington with her classmates, performing for her country at my inauguration. And a week later, she was shot and killed in a Chicago park after school, just a mile away from my house. Idea's parents, Nate and Cleo, are in this chamber tonight, along with more than 24 Americans whose lives have been torn apart by gun violence. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. Gabby Gifford deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote. They deserve a simple vote. Our actions will not prevent every senseless act of violence in this country. In fact, no laws, no initiatives, no administrative acts will perfectly solve all the challenges I've outlined tonight. But we were never sent here to be perfect. We were sent here to make what difference we can to secure this nation, expand opportunity, uphold our ideals through the hard, often frustrating, but absolutely necessary work of self-government. We were sent here to look out for our fellow Americans the same way they look out for one another every single day, usually without fanfare, all across this country. We should follow their example. We should follow the example of a New York City nurse named Menchu Sanchez. When Hurricane Sandy plunged her hospital into darkness, she wasn't thinking about how her own home was faring. Her mind was on the 20 precious newborns in her care and the rescue plan she devised that kept them all safe. We should follow the example of a North Miami woman named Desaline Victor. When Desaline arrived at her polling place, she was told the wait to vote might be 6 hours. As time ticked by, her concern was not with her tired body or aching feet, but whether folks like her would get to have their say. Hour after hour, a throng of people stayed in line to support her, because Desaline is 102 years old. And they erupted in cheers when she finally put on a sticker that read, "I voted." Well, what's that belief? Follow the example of a police officer named Brian Murphy. When a gunman opened fire on a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, Brian was the first to arrive, and he did not consider his own safety. He fought back until help arrived and ordered his fellow officers to protect the safety of the fellow Americans worshiping inside, even as he lay bleeding from 12 bullet wounds. And when asked how he did that, Brian said, "That's just the way we're made. That's just the way we're made." We may do different jobs and wear different uniforms and hold different views than the person beside us, but as Americans, we all share the same proud title. We are citizens.
Okay, it seems like we lost the power connection. That was the President of the United States. I guess while he was speaking, I was trying to surf for more information on the shooter, because all the news circuits went down and focused on the President. I was trying to see what was the outcome know what happened. The last that heard, I put it up now. Last I heard, there was a fight, a fire, a shootout and a fire. What y'all think about the president's speech, though? What's y'all take on it so far? I don't know how much time we got left in it because my system has went out. But so far, what do y'all think about the speech and how has it been? You know? And so what do you think about the Christopher Dahner situation? I'm waiting on KABC to come back on and KNBC to come back on to give me, excuse me, information upon that situation. Now, while I'm working on, is it in here? Has it ended the speech, Mitra?
Yes.
Okay, I see it has ended, so I guess what has happened was that it ended at the same time, and so they cut the situation off. So what I'm going to do, I guess, in this next hour that I have left, 5, 10, 15, 25, 30, 40, 50, 55 minutes I got left on Dahner, I'm not going to talk about the president's speech, how you feel about it, what y'all think about it, because I really want to talk about this manifesto. Now, in the hour, I'm going to try to go over it and read it, but for those who probably read it, please give me a call at 347-838-9825, and let's chop it up. Let's talk about it. Let's go on here as the president's making his way out, they say. I'm trying to get the live coverage. But let me go ahead and get... Hold on, Carl. I see you holding on. Thank you for holding on. Hey, if you want to talk about the president, we can talk about the president. But I'm having a hard time getting everything logged up because I had a power surge come across. And what I could do is play... Everything is just taking a slow time. Please call up there with me. I can't even get a music in or a situation. So let me try to go to WLS and see what they're saying right now.
A great deal. Again, I think everyone would acknowledge that was certainly the strongest, most emotional part of this speech. We do have people standing by already, ready to go on the air. Let's go to Sean listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, Sean. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? I was just wanting to comment that the president didn't make any remarks whatsoever about the drug problem in the city of Chicago. There is a problem with heroin, there's a problem with marijuana, there's a problem with cocaine, there's a problem with streaking that is out of control, and he has not even mentioned a word about it.
Well, again, sir, you could make a long list of things that he did not talk about, and certainly drugs and the involvement of drugs and their tied to the violence that erupts, not only in Chicago but around the country, is certainly part of that problem, and you're right, he did not address that, but he certainly addressed the broader image of the impact of the violence that really flows in the wake of drug usage and in the wake of certainly the turf battles. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that there is a link between the battle for turf within certain sectors of Chicago and also every urban area in the United States, and it definitely is tied to the violence that leads to it. But thank you very much. Let's go to Alan listening to. No, yes, go ahead, Sean. Oh, he's gone. Let's go to Alan in Raytown, Missouri, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello, I'd like to say I thought it was a very good speech, and I think he touched on a lot of areas. I also like to say I have to disagree with your caller if he was listening, because he touched on a program about the inner cities here in Kansas City. Well, we've had gun violence, and what they're doing is they're tearing down a lot of the old neighborhoods, and they're allowing those kids to go to work through a program, totally funded. get some education and go in there and help to reconstruct and start the labor with, going to work. And I think that's a lot easier. You know, these young men out here would like to go to work rather than try to get 10 years for prison for trying to sell crack cocaine. That's what you get out here in Kansas City.
Just to be blunt about it, clearly the president listed a variety of things that seemed to make sense. But again, he did not talk a great deal about how some of these programs would be changed and how they would be
starting up.
Okay, that's enough of that. Let me go in there and get back on Monitor Square and get into this Christopher Doran situation. 347-838-9825. Go in there, give me a call. Look for you, Cooley.
And we turn to the search for the ex-officer wanted in multiple killings in California. Authorities have been given hundreds of tips to the suspect, who's still alive, but he was charged today with the murder of a Riverside police officer.
If it wasn't
and
for
the
a little thing called a
computer officer, we might face charges to bring the death
to be making.
The manhunt was in its fifth day. Law enforcement agencies across Southern California kept looking for Christopher Dorn. Authorities said they're hoping a $1 million reward will yield new leads on Dorner's whereabouts.
Their dedication is right there. To catch a new killer remains steadfast.
You had to find a bunch of documents. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa announced the award yesterday.
Who will not tolerate this reign of terror?
Express lane finds you driving info with just one click.
Robbing us of the peace of mind that residents of Southern California deserve.
Dorner is wanted for the murder of a retired police captain's daughter and her fiancé in Irvine 8 days ago. The 33-year-old fugitive also allegedly killed a Riverside police officer in an ambush last Thursday. Investigators fear Dorner plans more killings as revenge against the L.A. Police Department. It fired him 5 years ago for falsely accusing his training officer of kicking a suspect. Authorities found Dorner's burned pickup truck near the Big Bear Ski Resort late last week, but they've since been forced to scale back the search in order to protect 50 police families believed to be in danger while still answering regular calls for assistance. Police Chief Charlie Beck.
Obviously, we're getting tips since the reward offer like crazy. We have three times the amount of tips that we did yesterday. We're following up on every one of them, you know, so hopefully there's a nugget in there that will lead us to his capture.
So far, there have only been false sightings of Dorner, including one at this Northridge area Lowe's store yesterday. Meanwhile, the L.A. Police Department has reopened its investigation into the case that prompted Dorner's firing. I spoke to Mayor Villaraigosa a short time ago to discuss how the city's dealing with the manhunt, as well as some of the questions raised by this case. Mayor, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's start with the state of the search. Is there any progress to report? Who's helping you, and where are you concentrating?
I can't tell you that there's any progress to report. I can't tell you that we're following many, many leads. It's over 1,000 leads now. We're looking for him. We've got our best detectives and investigators on this. We're working with the city of Irvine and the city of and county of Riverside, the county of San Bernardino, the Marshals Service, the FBI. We're all working and collaborating to find Christopher Dorner as soon as possible.
You mentioned the large number of leads. Have some of those come in response to your recently offered $1 million reward?
Yes, some have come in response to that, but we're following every single lead.
Mr. Speaker,
we take
in the
this
House
matter very, very seriously.
The on the motion
remember, there are three people who's targeted some 50 individuals and their families who clearly is bent on some kind of revenge, and we're doing everything we can to find him, to arrest him, and to bring him to justice.
You mentioned the target list. You've also got a large number of LAPD assets involved in the search itself. Add to that an event like the Grammy Awards with a large number of VIPs in town. Has your police department been spread a little thin the last couple of days?
Well, they're certainly feeling the strain of having to deploy as many resources as they have, and particularly during this time. But I'll tell you, I couldn't be prouder of the men and women of the Los Angeles Police Department and of the law enforcement agencies that have been working on this. They take this personal when people's families are being subjected to threats of this nature, and they're working as hard as they can to bring Christopher Dorner to justice.
Are there any credible sightings since Thursday when the burned-out pickup truck was found, or any reasonable tips that give you an idea of his movements?
No, there are no credible sightings that I know of, and I've been briefed almost hourly, and certainly whenever there's a new development. I can tell you that we're following every lead. We don't know his whereabouts, but we have extended the area that we're looking for him in. We're doing everything we can. We recognize what a threat he is to the public and to the people on that list.
In recent days, your police chief, Charlie Beck, has announced that he wants to reopen, re-examine the files of the case that led to the firing of Christopher Dorner. Why did your chief feel that was necessary? What might be in there?
Well, look, the chief is committed to constitutional policing, committed to making sure that our department is transparent as possible in everything we do in order to address any concerns that some in the public may have with respect to what happened in the case of Mr. Dorner. He's reopened this investigation, but I'll say this. There is absolutely nothing, Ray, nothing that could have happened to him to justify killing three people in cold blood, three innocent people. Remember, he ambushed Officer Crane and his partner. He shot at and tried to kill two LAPD officers. He killed Captain Kwan's daughter and her fiancé in cold blood. This is a man who's hell-bent on mayhem and destruction, who's willing to kill, and nothing that could have happened to him justifies those kinds of atrocious acts, frankly.
This is not in any way to justify or explain what Christopher Dorner has done, but when the city is in a crisis like this, when there is a case of this kind, is there a history that has to be reckoned with between the LAPD and the people of the city of Los Angeles, between the officers of color and the people of color and the LAPD?
Well, look, as you probably know, we were under a consent decree for a long time. I have worked hard with the chief and with Chief Bratton before him to get us out of that consent decree. We are absolutely committed to constitutional and community policing. There is more public support among communities of color for our police department than any time in our history. We are now the most diverse that we've ever been. About almost 75% of our police officers come from communities of color, Latino, African American, and Asian. About 20% are women. We are absolutely committed to working and collaborating with every community, to respecting the rights of the people in our community. And as I said, this is a separate matter that the chief decided that we were going to be as transparent as possible with respect to what happened to Mr. Dorner. But as I said, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that justifies killing people in cold blood in the way that he has. And there are many who would say that the department was right in firing him, given what he has done now in this situation.
Antonio Villaraigosa is the mayor of Los Angeles. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Online, we link to resources from Southern California Public Radio.
What's going on?
A timeline of events.
You're getting an interesting
reaction
and some interesting people you've talked to.
I have, but I want to just kind of give you an update that I'm getting from my sources in terms of what the current concern is in terms of where Christopher Dorner is. The next place that law enforcement is going to really focus on is the potential of an attack on where any of the funerals may be for any of the people
mm-hmm.
who have been murdered by him, because that is going to be a high target place where it could have a collection of people who are on Dorner's list. So if he is still on the loose, it's going to be unprecedented amount of security. That's what I'm hearing from law enforcement briefings. I want to make sure I gave you the news, because I know that we do news here.
Yes, we do. There are 40 units protecting families right now.
Right.
Now you'll have the funerals. The funerals are a high target area. But we all know what Christopher Dorner looks like. They all know what he looks like, so he can't go, unless he's disguised, into the funeral, right?
Well, I mean, right now he's been able to utilize the elements of surprise, his training, his knowledge. He undoubtedly knows how high-security funerals, law enforcement funerals are
right.
done and conducted. He'll know how to potentially stake out a site beforehand or how to utilize the, you know.
But they know that he knows.
Right.
So
that's the game that's going on right now.
And by training as a sniper, among other things, they'll certainly be checking every angle, every rooftop, every whatever. It's not just a movie. This is real life.
That is. But I just wanted to give you
okay.
the latest there. And the other half of what I've been looking at right now has been reaction. I know that Lisa's been looking at it in terms of Facebook, and we've been getting a ton of reaction here into the station. And most notably, people from law enforcement with law enforcement history, not condoning.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to be very clear that I
yes.
personally don't condone
no,
any of the behavior. I know,
right.
and no
okay.
one does.
Yes.
However, there is this light being shined on this issue of, you know, is there any truth and veracity as to what Dorner has said in his manifesto? And I've been looking at the documents, and I think that there has been, you know, we are becoming a place right now, and we'll hear from some of these people who have come to me saying, listen, racism is pervasive in LAPD. We have not improved as much as we've wanted to since Rodney King. There is a code of silence. You can't report your supervisors. Those themes are themes that are out there, and they can't be just dismissed while we're looking for him.
Is there any police department that functions in this country that doesn't have a code of silence?
I have not seen it. I think it's an element and an aspect of law enforcement.
Yeah.
But I think
and part of it is very bad, and part of it brings unit cohesion, because you're looking out for each other.
Right. I mean, and one of the things that I've talked to some of these officers about is, you know, on the face, LAPD seems to be very diversified. I mean, I've worked with every different type of ethnicity.
Two African-American police chiefs in the last 15 years.
Right. So, that part was surprising me, to think, you know, racism is as pervasive as it is, when there is so much ethnicity within the department itself and from every level. But there are people who will say that it is still run, the decisions at the top still are an old boys club, and that racism is still prevalent, and you can't report anything, because if you do, various repercussions will happen. From, you know, one of the repercussions that I've been hearing is, okay, if you report something, you don't want to be that cop that then calls for backup, because guess what, backup's not going to come to help you. And this hazing stuff that we've heard about that, you know, has still exists. So these are things that we're looking at. Of course, it doesn't condone anything in any way.
It's a big city police department, and yeah, there are all kinds of issues. I said earlier, in other societies, men self-immolate. They burn themselves on the steps of the police department or the courthouse
right.
to make their point. They take their own lives to get the attention focused on the issue.
Well, it's like the suicide bombers.
Yes.
I mean, I wish that Chris Dorner...
I'm saying those people aren't like the suicide bombers.
Right. Yeah.
They're killing
themselves
to make the point.
True.
That's one way of making the point, rather than killing innocent family members.
Right. Well, and why didn't Chris Dorner call me and say, I would love the news to expose this. Why didn't he send the package to Anderson Cooper before he started killing anybody?
Because you're not dealing with an emotionally balanced mind, quite obviously. Read the manifesto.
Right.
There are points in the manifesto where you say, that makes a lot of sense. And then why did he put... But we are discussing, as Chief Beck said, whatever you feel about the police department,
right.
what Chief Beck said, you're talking about a homicide guy here.
That's
we're,
right.
We're starting to quote his philosophy.
That's
here.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And also, it should be noted that there are a lot of fantastic, wonderful
yeah,
police
sure.
officers, and
yeah,
this is
yeah.
not necessarily everybody, but it can be true of someone's experience.
All right, you folks are all weighing in, by the way, on Facebook. So if you go to our Facebook, what is the address here? It's
Fox LA.
Fox LA Los Angeles on Facebook. You go ahead and weigh in what you hear with Robin.
Thanks for your face, London. Everybody in the house, make some noise. I want everybody in the house to say, ho! Your truck, kick it to him, man.
A ballad behind bars, or you could say real rock from the rock. An unusual musical happening in a most unusual place. The state prison
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me. The suckers had authority. Cold sweat never dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run. Brother like me's begun to be another one. Told the enemy serving time. They drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless, they could not understand that I'm a black man and I can never be a veteran. On the strength of situations unreal, I got a raw deal. So I'm looking for the steal.
Hey, yo, Chuck, you serious? You in the justice, man?
Word them up. I'm looking for that steal.
Yo, man, we gonna break you out of there, man. We ain't gonna like that, man.
Don't you know they got me rotten in the time that I'm serving? Telling you what happened the same time they're sowing. Four of us packed in a cell like slaves. Oh, well, the same motherfucker got us living in his hell. You have to realize what is the form of slavery organized under a form of devil. Straight up, word them up on the level. The reasons are several, most of them federal.
Yeah.
Here's my plan anyway, and I say I got gusto. But only some I can trust, yo. Some do a bit, some on the 10. But I never did, and plus I never been. I'm on a tier with no tears should ever fall. Cell blocked and locked, I never clock it, y'all. Cause time and time again, time they got me serving to those of them. I'm not a citizen, but ever when I catch the CO, sleeping on the job, my plan is on go ahead. I want a strength, but I'ma tell you the deal. I got nothing to lose, cause I'm going for the steal.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we gonna break you out of here, man. Word of strength, G.
I'm going for that steal.
Word up, G. They're trying to put black out of the game by keeping you in there, you know what I'm saying? But you can't keep a good man down.
Got it. Got me in the cell.
Hey, yo, Chuck, we got
it. Then I threw up, my steel bullets flew up.
Doors open at 8 p.m.
$3 shot drinks, $5 mixed drinks,
$10 admission. Ladies, you're free before 11. 25 and over with ID a must. Green Light Buffet, upstairs, a live performance from Montana Black and the sounds of DJ Smooth.
Valentine's Day, new school, old school hip hop music Thursday.
And every Thursday at Pulaski Hall, West Hunting Point Ave, across from Gratz High School. Relax downstairs and chill.
Mingle and have uninterrupted conversations.
25 and over with ID a must. $3 shot drinks, $5 mixed drinks, $10 admission. It's new school, old school hip hop music Thursday at Pulaski Hall,
West Hunting Point Ave, across from Gratz High School.
Another Black Ink Incorporated production.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our home ownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sangsyl.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit goldandsilverplan.com. That's goldandsilverplan.com. What you don't know can keep you struggling financially. What you know can change your life. Be in the know. Visit goldandsilverplan.com today.
Hey, you want more money in your pocket, right? Savers are losers, unless you save like the rich and beat inflation. The secret? Save the right kind of money. Pure, solid, 24-karat gold or silver for as little as $20 a week, direct from the mint. Don't spend money. Exchange bad money for good money. Start today at SaveMetalMoney.com. That's SaveMetalMoney.com. The chains of slavery in the modern world are not forged with links of iron, but with the bonds of limiting ideas and debt.
Be in business for yourself, but not by yourself. Team up with a company voted the 57th most promising by Forbes. With no money to collect from your customers, no credit checks, and no cost for you to join. Visit electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288. That's electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288.
Hi there, I'm the X-Man, Xavier Paul. I'm a national network voiceover talent. You've heard my voice represent hundreds of brands and businesses for the past 15 years. Well, now it's your turn. I understand how important it is to promote your business or event in the right way. That starts with quality radio spot production and the nation's top voiceover talent. You might wonder, how do I get started? What's the best approach? What voice talent do I use? And most importantly, can I do it affordably? That's why I created CoolVoiceRadio.com. I take you to the finish line, giving you everything you need to advertise effectively on the radio. I'll help you create your concept, write your spot, even choose your music and cast your voice talent and get it aired on the radio. Now that's cool. Email me today at info@coolvoiceradio.com or call 646-326-7800 because nothing beats the right sound.
Reading Twitter about the situation, you know, they go on in there to see if the body's there. You know, the man just snapped. We're going to take care of the manifesto. I'm running out of time. I'm going to do a little tribute to Nat Turner, but yo, Christopher Dart, this is dedicated to you because I know you were just venting.
Hey, let's go to McDonald's.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, man. Let's see a goof, McDonald's.
You're going to work for me until I tell you to quit.
You don't own me, pig, and no motherfucker tells me when I can split.
Who the fuck do you think you're talking to?
I'm talking to you, redneck faggot.
Here I sit, eating Christmas dinner leftovers. Constantly toting bullshit on my shoulders. I'm frigid. Heart keeps getting colder. Solving the case, the truth is getting closer. Shit on these fools on the bus to your Range Rover. Similar to Jigga on niggas, I take over. Mr. 4655, please move over. Always survive the floods of madness like Noah. White boy goose and your crew, a bunch of jokers. This goes for all of y'all, I'm hanging up wanted posters. Mad coin won't happen until if you get focused. Play the enemy and feel the wrath of Black Sosa. Fuck your best friend over the sofa. Bender over. Kids were sleeping, had to sneak out. Beautiful weekend. And if she was to call now, I would do it again. Violent bars, so please stop with the grins. You whispering niggas bleed milk like Sean Penn. Eyes to the sky like God, where have you been? They got kids, instead I kill them with a pen. Fuck all you bitter bitches who can't recognize we're men. I'm bitten, a few names will be mentioned. If you cross that line, I will attack, no restrictions. Steven, I would have took you off this planet if it was for your cousin, while all you young niggas wanna die trying to prove something. Fumbling niggas can't handle me. On 131, he created a masterpiece. I ask myself, why the fuck are y'all mad at me? Don't be surprised when I start speaking my piece. Kids, mama talking shit, wanna check her cavities. Nah, I won't do the penitentiary. I apologize for my people, I owe money. Mayday, mayday, they burned down the cafe. Damn, these are the last days before I leave a woman on show, Ray J. Can't do shit, nay, nay. Confused pretty bitches, you can get the payday. I'm so fly, Mr. O'Hare, midway. Learn from me, no replay to sensei. They mad, cause I have kids now. Like dogs and strangers, bitch, get down. Just Maggie and Millie, you motherfuckers are loud. Please, with both of y'all, put something in your mouth. I'm tired of the nonsense, this is free music. And no, it's not comedy. Out like Mike Vick, full-fledged lyricist, complicated like pyramids. God damn it, y'all got me irritated. Any challenge in front of me, nigga, I will face it. And leave you looking stupid till they say go get a facelift.
Live humble, humble, humble yourself to deal and wrong. Live humble.
Born into slavery, a life of trouble and pain. Many things would eventually lead to the tragic Nat Turner Slave Rebellion. In the summer of 1831, Nat Turner led a slave revolt that sent shockwaves throughout the South. This bloody uprising created a great conflict for plantation owners and slaves alike. This potentially national-scale conflict sent a message to slaves everywhere that revolting would lead to a tragic compromise. At the time of the Nat Turner Slave Revolt, slavery was at its height. The North had abolished many of its slaves, but the South was still the world's greatest cotton producer, and abolishing slavery would ruin this. One slave child said, "I saw my mammy beat until she was just a living piece of raw meat." John Brown, a violent American abolitionist, said, "Slavery is the sin of America." Nat Turner was born in Southampton County, Virginia, on October 2, 1800. He was born into slavery on the plantation of Benjamin Turner. Little is known about Nat's childhood. He attempted to escape this cruel life a few times, but was never successful. Nat Turner was extremely religious. He even baptized himself in a local creek. He would pray every night to God, and even believed he spoke to God himself. Nat Turner even believed he was the Black Moses, and he was ready to lead his people out of slavery.
Well, it takes to an extreme the black slave interpretation of the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament. But if you look at the book of Exodus, and, you know, I mean, the story of the Hebrews escaping from slavery into freedom, which, not surprisingly, was a favorite among African American slaves.
He really saw himself as
Jesus' ambassador, as the Black Moses of the time.
31. There was an eclipse of the sun. Turner took this to be the sign that he had been promised, and confided his plan to the four men he trusted the most: Henry, Park, Nelson, and Sam. They decided to hold the insurrection on the 4th of July and began planning a strategy. However, they had to postpone action because Turner became ill.
On August 21st, 1831, Nat Turner started his rebellion. That evening, Turner and six other men met in the woods. At 2 a.m., they went to the home of Nat Turner's master. They killed the master, the wife, and the children in the house. As they left the house and got a mile down the road, they realized that they had left a baby in his cradle. Henry and Will went back and killed the baby, while Nat and Nelson went on to the next house.
The next house along the way was the Gills Reese house. Turner killed Reese, and he had a young slave woman named Cherry, who supposedly was Turner's wife.
From this point on, Turner would go around and kill the families, and then recruit the slaves as a part of his rebellion. One example of this is the Catherine Whitehead House, also locally known as the Skikes House. There, he killed the family and buried them in the garden, and then recruited the slaves as a part of his rebellion.
One story of survival was the Nathaniel Francis House, where a slave concealed Mrs. Lavinia Francis in the attic. Thus, her life was spared.
On September 17, 1831, Governor John Floyd issued a proclamation for the reward and capture of Nat Turner.
This is the nightmare that they had even tried to rule out using the Fugitive Slave Act involved in the Constitution. Article 6 of the Constitution allows the U.S. government to use federal troops to put down slave rebellion. That tells you how much white Southerners feared slave revolt.
On October 31st, Ben Phipps, a local farmer, spotted and captured Nat Turner at gunpoint.
My name it is Paul Pilgrim, to Maine, and I am bound, traveling through this.
Soon after, Turner was taken to the Southampton County Jail. There, he was appointed a lawyer, Thomas Ruffin Gray. Gray talked to Turner for days after he was captured. He then took it upon himself to write the Confessions of Nat Turner, a book read by most of the area at the time. In one instance, Gray asked Turner, "You know you're going to be hanged, right?" And Turner replied, "Was Christ not crucified?" This statement would be heard by most of the county and added to what the people thought of Turner.
In the next couple of months, every rebel except Nat Turner was quickly killed or captured. During September and into October, nearly 50 accused rebels stood trial in Southampton County. Almost all were executed by hanging.
On November 5th, 1831, Nat Turner was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. The trial only took 48 hours. The man who said, "Was Christ not crucified?" was hanged on November 11th in Jerusalem, Virginia. Now known as Cortland, Virginia, his body was then flayed, beheaded, and quartered.
In the bloody aftermath, close to 200 blacks, many of whom had nothing to do with the rebellion, were beaten, tortured, and murdered by angry white mobs. In addition, repressive policies were enacted for not only the enslaved blacks, but also many of the freedmen. No other slave uprising inflicted as severe a blow to the community of slave owners in the United States. Nat is and will forever be regarded as a hero by many African Americans.
Nat Turner finally became well-known in present-day life in the 1940s when historian Herbert Apthorpe published the first serious scholarly work on instances of slavery resistance in the antebellum South.
Oh, I salute the end, as you all know. Say it's where the gym alone, Chelsea's on the go. Chelsea's all rise when the bell does ring.
1968, William Strayton wrote a controversial book about Nat Turner, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. This book was very controversial because many of the facts mentioned were actually false. Nat Turner was introduced once again into present-day life in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement. Nat was an inspiration for the leaders and for the followers of the movement. Malcolm X quoted Nat in many of his speeches and actions, using violence instead of nonviolent protest as Nat did in his rebellion.
Shine on till tomorrow, let it be.
North America, but there were no successful slave rebellions in North or South America. Only in the Caribbean with the Haitian Rebellion do you see a successful slave rebellion.
Swing low.
In conclusion, Nat Turner created a huge conflict in which he ended up killing over 55 white men, women, and children. He recruited over 40 slaves as a part of his rebellion. With such a huge conflict, a compromise had to be met, but none was produced. The eventual compromise of the battle he was fighting would be the end of the Civil War. Nat Turner set the stage for all men to stand up for what they believed in, even if it was extreme.
Swing down chariots, won't you? Let me ride, oh,
swing down chariots, stop and let me ride, oh, rock me, Lord, rock me, Lord, come and eat,
I got a home,
I got a home.
In the words of Frederick Douglass,
the thing worse than rebellion is the thing that causes rebellion.
Underground Radio, everybody. Good night, and may your God be with you. Let's see what happens tomorrow. All right, Christopher Donner. We're going to go ahead and do your dossier tomorrow.
Yeah. So hard.